Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. I have another podcasting guest today. Actually, he has his own podcast and is also a PA, and his name is Chris Madej. So, Chris, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Chris Madej. As Chip said, we kind of connected via the interwebs of Twitter and FoamMed, and I have my own podcast. It's called The Pain Podcast, Pain standing for Physician Assistant in Education, because my primary gig is I'm an assistant professor, and currently I'm the academic coordinator at the University of Alabama at Birmingham PA program, but starting in January of 2017, I'm actually going to be taken over as the new program director for the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. So my background is primarily in education. That's what I do full time. But my practice experience has been in trauma, critical care, into emergency medicine. And currently I'm doing urgent care in the land of milk and honey, as you will. And sort of just got into the whole FOMED movement, jumped in feet first, and been loving it ever since. So I appreciate the opportunity of being able to come on your show.
Yes, well, thank you for joining us. And we're going to talk about airways today. So we'll get started on that in just a second.
Well, excellent. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to doing this today, just because I haven't had an opportunity to do any kind of an interview format. And so far, the interviews that you've been doing on your show have been great. A lot of heavy hitters in the foam world. So hopefully I'll be able to, or you and I will be able to make a little bit of a dent on the topic today, which is just going to be basic airway management or essential airway management, steps of intubation for students out there that may be going into critical care or emergency medicine. You know, there's a lot of talk on a lot of the airway adjuncts, complicated airways, surgical airways, can intubate, can oxygenate, and there's just not a lot out there on just the basic stuff. So this is what Chip and I thought we were going to tackle today, which is just going through what do you as a student need to know when your attending looks at you and says, have you ever intubated before, and what are the steps that you need to do? So that's kind of how the approach that we're going to use on today's show.
And that's a great point. I think we should actually talk about here real quick. You actually came up with some good materials. It's kind of like you've almost taught people before.
I know, right?
Yeah. I don't know how that worked out. But you came up with some basic steps on an approach based on different models like the 7 P's for intubation. And So I guess we should kind of get started on basically how we get ready to intubate someone.
That's right. So my dad, being a military brat and being grown up in the military, my dad always talked about, you know, the 7 P's of proper preparation and planning prevents piss poor performance. and that's kind of always stuck with me. So when I started learning about steps of intubation when I was a student, and then certainly trying to come up with, you know, ways to teach students on it, kind of always fell back on that. When I saw the 7 P's of intubation, I thought that it fit perfect with that. So the first P that we typically will start with is just your preparation. You know, the first step in getting ready to intubate somebody is not jumping straight to the blade and diving in. It's making sure that you have everything laid out, because there's a lot of things that can go further, complications and things that just occur that if you don't have everything in place, can really make yourself be unsuccessful with not only the attempt, but sometimes not even getting started. I mean, I'm sure that we've all been in a situation where, you know, you're getting ready to say, okay, go ahead and push the drugs, and the nurse looks at you and says, well, you didn't tell me what to draw up, and now you've pre-oxygenated and you've got it all set up. And so it's a nice way for you to sit back and say, what all do I need to do this properly? So Chip, what are some things that you always like to have at the bedside before you even start to think about doing the actual procedure?
So we're only a few minutes into this podcast, and I'm going to invoke Scott Weingart because he is one of the airway kings, and he's got a pretty good checklist. To be honest, whether I have that checklist in hand, which I'd encourage, especially if you're new to this, have a checklist. But even if you're just, hey, you're assisting someone and maybe they don't use a checklist or whatever, the big things in my mind to do intubation correctly is, of course, you need the drugs. That's a pretty big one. You need your laryngoscope and probably a backup of some kind, whether you're a VL first kind of guy like me or a DL verse like a lot of other people are. By the way, VL and DL stand for video laryngoscopy and direct laryngoscopy. And so for me, I want to have whatever tools I'm going to use to actually put that tube down. So that includes that. It includes the ET tube. Some people use a bougie. Some use stylets, especially if you're using VL. You're going to get a specialized stylet usually. But whatever technique you have, you need to have something so that tube is not just naked. Anesthesiologists may be able to do it in a controlled setting. I can't. I'm not going to rely on that tube going the right place. Speaking of tube, you need to figure out the right size. With sick patients, we want to like actually get smaller tubes. That's what you think you want to do because you want to guarantee getting it through that cords. But really what you need to realize are those cords actually, with the whole issue, and once you put in the trachea over time with critical illness and whatnot, you want a bigger tube if you can get it through. And with a lot of bronchs, at least where I was at, if you want to do a bronchoscopy, you're going to have an 8-0 size tube or bigger. So plan on what you're going to need, not only then, but further down the line. A good sized tube is appropriate. And then you got to remember, you need something to actually put air through, or if you're going to do saline for whatever reason, but usually you're going to put air. So you need to have that syringe to push the air in the cuff. But those are the big ones, like automatically you cannot forget kind of thing, because those are the basics of what you need. The other thing you got to keep in mind is you need a difficult airway cart / backup tools. So you should never plan for an intubation, in my mind. You should never plan an intubation without at least considering what's going to happen if it fails. Do you have some sort of supraglottic airway, and or do you have other methods such as front of neck access type things, like a surgical crike? And right. So I want to have all that stuff ready to go. And there are some others too, like ventilator, bag valve mask, all those types of things. I don't know if that's something you want to go over.
Well, I mean, I think it paints to a good point of, you know, we're sort of having this conversation as two practicing PAs who are going to be doing the procedure. But obviously, this is very much a team effort, and there's going to be a lot of people getting a lot of different things together. And this is an opportunity for the students out there to really look and see who else is going to be helping with this. And in most of the departments that I've ever worked at, we've always had a dedicated respiratory therapist, if not two, in the department at all times. And they would be the ones who have taught me everything. When I look at them and say, hey, what do you think I need for this? And they would say, well, let's go ahead and get this, that, and the other out. So, you know, look around the room, you know, make friends with the respiratory therapist. And sometimes if you just hang out with them during the intubations, you're going to pick up on all of the little tricks, all the little tips. They've been doing it for a long, long period of time. And you're going to see all of the little tiny things they do to make the procedure go smooth when the doc or the PA or whoever's doing the intubation is going through things. Sometimes it's just these little tiny, you know, maneuvers where they do a little bit of this, or they hand them this, or they say, well, why don't you try to tip your blade this way a little bit? You know, talk to them and say, hey, you know, what are we doing if this fails? And they'll say, well, in this particular drawer of the crash cart is our difficult airway. Okay, well, what all goes in there? What all do we have there? So I kind of have an idea. And just talking with them about it, because everybody's going to have their things that they always go to, whether it's the, you know, the scaring off the demons by just splashing the neck with a little bit of betadine, or is it just having the fiber optic in the room just enough that it's there so that if you start to have problems, you know, if you got your backup.
I like that. So do you think we've covered preparation pretty well? Maybe we should move on to position.
Yep. So the next P is positioning. So there is a lot of really good videos. And again, since Chip has already brought Scott Weingart into the world, I'm going to go ahead and do it again, because he's actually got a really good video where he breaks down the positioning that's best for intubation. And it used to be that they always talked about the sniffing position, right, where you want the nose kind of up, and he does a really good demonstration that when you're actually sniffing things and somebody holds out a bouquet of flowers, you know, you don't tilt your chin towards them, right? You kind of stick your neck out and you put your nose towards it. And that's the position that you want to be in. And one of the things that I tell my students is you want the ear hole to chest hole. You want the external auditory meatus to line up with the sternal notch. And however you do that is fine, whether it's going to be, the patient lying flat, or what I really prefer to do, which is, and honestly, I can never remember whether it's reverse Trendelenburg or regular Trendelenburg, but you want the head up. So a lot of times just having the head of the bed up with a bump underneath the shoulder blades, gets the sternal notch and gets the shoulders up and gets the head into the position where you can just be standing there and you can almost envision yourself looking straight through the mouth, straight down into the cords. You don't want to be bent over. You want to put yourself into a position of success. And these are a lot of the little tiny things that you don't pick up on until you get into a really difficult intubation when you're bent over, you're really struggling to get that head up. And then all it takes is just a little bit of raising the bed to get you into a position where you're then going to be successful. So what kind of things do you like to do from a positioning standpoint, Chip?
Well, I actually want to bounce off of something you said here real quick, and that is about laying the patient completely supine. You know, that's the way you've done it for years, but I want you to think about something. I want you to go up against the wall, have your heels, have your shoulder, everything completely flat against it, including your head, and then try and breathe. For most of us, that's not actually very easy, and you'll realize because you're actually making your airway harder to get through. And so now try and bring your head a little bit forward, and you'll realize it's a little bit easier to breathe. You bring your shoulders and your head out, makes it that much easier. That's that ramping concept that you mentioned. And so for me, that's one of the biggest things. If you want to try and get position right, is bringing that head and even that chest, like you said, ear to sternal notch. That's a very easy way to think of it. And then maybe a slight tilt back of the head. But you really don't have to do much of the head tilting if you get the patient positioned right.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And these are the things where if you as a student recognize that and you know that you're with your preceptor, you know, Chip, if you've got a student on your service and you're like, hey, yeah, we're going to need to intubate this guy, you know, I'm going to go ahead and head over and put in some orders and, you know, get some meds drawn up, that if you want to be a rock star on that service, you go into that room with that patient and you go ahead and put them in that position so that when your preceptor walks in, they see that you know what you're doing. The likelihood of them giving you the opportunity to do that procedure then goes up exponentially.
Agreed.
So now that we've got the patient, we've got our equipment out, we've got all the things that we're going to need to do the procedure, we've got them positioned where we want them, the next step is going to be pre-oxygenation. So what's your take on your pre-oxygenation?
So I believe personally that there is still a role for apneic oxygenation. So one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to strap a nasal cannula on. I'm going to have it on high flow, about as high as I can go, at least 15 liters per minute. But if I can get to crank up higher, that much better, especially when the patient is at least, because hopefully you're providing them some analgesia at this point. So it makes them a little more comfortable with this idea of having a lot of oxygen going up their nose. So that's going to be one of my things is let's get him oxygenated. Yeah, he may not be unconscious yet. Yeah, he may not be apneic yet. But if you can get that oxygenation and get that blowing out and really replace, you know, denitrogenation, placing oxygen where that nitrogen was, you're going to do better and you're going to last longer. So anyway, you put that nasal cannula on, you crank it up all the way, and then you put a non-rebreather on if they're still breathing with you and you have them take big, deep breaths. Try and get as much of that nitrogen out and try and introduce as much of that oxygen as possible. And then once you start going into the point where you're going to need to introduce something else, say a bag valve mask, have that ready too. Optimum technique, we're usually not very good in our setting and think about all the different patients we have, that really one person should be having a two-handed seal and the other person bagging. And if you don't have all those extra hands, you can actually put that bag in most cases under your arm and squeeze it against your chest. That's a little more of an advanced technique, and that's one to practice when you get a chance. But at least at this stage, I would say look into that and consider that as a potential option. Right. And you want to try and pre-oxygenate as much as possible, at least for a few minutes. So would you like to talk about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you were to get pimped on your rotation in terms of how long you need to pre-oxygenate for, I think most of the textbooks are going to tell you 3 to 5 minutes is going to give you proper denitrogenation and proper full oxygenation where everything is as saturated as possible so that during the attempt you don't get that critical desaturation. So if you get asked that question, 3 to 5 minutes I think is reasonable. There may be some opportunities where you would want to go a little bit longer than that, but certainly you don't want to shortchange yourself by any means, because your pre-oxygenation status is really what's going to allow you to have that time while you're doing the intubation. And what it's kind of always been hammered into me by my preceptors is that pre-oxygenation period is not a luxury. It is the opportunity for you to be as successful as possible, because you figured if you are just taking really you know, short, tiny breaths, and then you try to hold your breath for as long as you can. When you're healthy, you're really only looking at maybe 15, 30 seconds at the most where you can tolerate holding that breath. Whereas if you really give yourself a good, long, big, deep breath out, big, deep breath in, you could probably go 30 seconds, 45 seconds. And that's how you got to imagine this. When you push that paralytic and this patient stops breathing, the only thing that is going to fix them is either a tube in the trachea or to bail on the procedure and give them more oxygen. So one of the things that I really liked, and I've heard some other people, I don't know if it's on the SMAC podcast or something else that I've listened to, but an old crotchety respiratory therapist that I trained with at one of the rural ERs would say that whenever he would have new attendings or new trainees come in, he would tell them that until he feels comfortable with them intubating, he wants them holding their breath while they're doing the intubation. Uh-huh. And if they can't handle it, then they need to come out. And that's always kind of stuck with me. And the first couple of times I've tried that, when your adrenaline's on edge, you really want to just keep going and going and going and going and going, and you kind of lose track of how long you're in. So this pre-oxygenation period is absolutely essential, because it's going to give you more time to find what you need to find the structures and get that tube in.
And then holding the breath isn't perfect, but it is definitely a start, especially when you're training. Let's say you haven't even got to the patient yet. Preceptor wants to show you, or you're practicing on your own, which kudos if you're practicing on your own. But say you're working, yeah, that'd be great. So say you're working on a mannequin. Well, mannequin's not going to give you that feedback. So hold your breath and really get used to that. And then as you get better and as you get quicker, quit doing the breath holding, be more realistic, because hopefully you're not going to hold your breath while you're actually doing it. You may for the first couple of times get used to it, but mm-hmm. really with proper training, you need to avoid things that you aren't going to do on a regular basis. Tactical breathing, yes, I definitely go with tactical breathing just to help bring your heart rate down and stuff. But breath holding, it's good to practice initially until you get things down, and then hopefully you're getting away from that.
Right, exactly. So we've prepared, we got everything at the bedside, we have positioned, we got them where we need them, they've got the mask, nasal cannula, we've been pre-oxygenating. So now the next step is we're getting into our medications, and this can fall under sort of the pre-medication part of the P's. You know, this is one of the things that I always try to stress with my students is, you know, there's always two drugs that you want to give when you intubate, but it's very important the order at which you give them, because it's fairly poor form to paralyze somebody and not sedate them first. So you always want to think about your pre-medication as in giving your patient some form of an anxiolytic or sedative, so that they kind of forget that you're getting ready to chemically paralyze them. And, you know, my go-to, and again, I'm sort of a product of foam, is, you know, I've been really using a lot of ketamine these days.
Yay, ketamine.
Is still sort of my go-to. You know, 1 to 2 mg per kg as an IV push dose will get you by. But there's a whole host of other ones out there. Etomidate is another good one that, from my trauma training, was what they intubated everybody with, which is a 0.3 mg per kg dosing. And the reason why we like to use it from a trauma standpoint is you don't see as much hemodynamic instability that you would see with, say, midazolam or propofol. But the things you got to think about from a critical care standpoint is it can cause some adrenal suppression when they get up to the unit, or if they're going to be down in your department for a long period of time. So it's always something to think about as a sequelae of using that medicine. And then, of course, you've got your old standbys, your propofol and your midazolam or your Versed. The propofol, anywhere between, you know, 1 to 2 mg per kg is what I've always been classically taught. And midazolam is about the same dosing as etomidate, you know, 0.3 to 0.5 mg per kg. What's your sedative of choice, Chip?
Optimally, it's ketamine. Sometimes ketamine is a hard thing to get a hold of depending on my setting, but I really do believe ketamine's a great option. It definitely is better in some ways compared to propofol in a sick patient, because keep in mind, if you already have a sick, you know, potentially hypotensive patient, if you want to kill your patient, I mean, propofol is a great choice.
What does Weingart say? It's a smooth kill?
Yeah, laryngoscope is a murder weapon type thing. Then, yeah, why not go ahead and use some propofol? Now, I would keep in mind that with pretty much any drug you're going to use, both anxiolytic and paralytic, again, going back to that, like, Scott Weingart checklist or other appropriate checklists, look at the dosing. Dosing is going to be lower, usually a tenth of your regular dose. Remember, you can always add more. It's hard to take away a medicine. So if you need to put a little bit more and a little bit more, and you've got the appropriate time where you can do that smoothly, try and do that first. Don't snow your patient in the wrong way, and now they're all hypotensive before you even started your procedure. That's just poor
form. That's a great tip. That's a great tip, because you get focused in on what the dosing should be, and you want to go ahead and give that up front. And it only takes about one or two times as a practicing PA to realize that if you give that big slug up front, that, like you said, it's kind of hard to take it back. So you tend to get a little gun shy the next time you go. And as long as the situation warrants it, I think that that's the right way to do it, is just kind of dose it until you get to where you want. And over time, the experience is going to come in terms of figuring out what that perfect window of medicine for your patient's going to be.
Well, I guess we talked about already about pre-medicating with our anxiolytic or a sedative. What about a paralytic? What should we go to?
Well, and that is, does rocks rock, or does sucks sucks is really what it comes down to. And there's two schools of thought with that, and I've used both in the past. And again, being a product of FOMED, I've really gone over to the rock uranium side of things over the last few years. And the nice thing is the dosing for me is easy to remember. I'm very much a rock ketamine guy. And the dosing for me is pretty standard. It's the 1 mg/kg for both of them. So from a cognitive load standpoint, trying to remember all of these dosings, you want to try to make it as easy as possible. And that's kind of what I have always fallen back on, is that the dosing is easy to remember. If I do 1 mg/kg for both of those, for the most part, that's going to get me by pretty well. The succinylcholine is a really good drug. It's been used for a long period of time. It still has its uses. The dosing is anywhere from 1 to 2 mg/kg IV. But the questions that you're going to get asked on clinical service is, why wouldn't you want to use succinylcholine? And the main reasons that you want to think about is hyperkalemia, because it is a depolarizing neuromuscular blocker. So it's going to cause some of those cells sometimes to lyse, and you can get a clinically significant hyperkalemia, although I've never seen anybody go into, sine wave hyper-K, but I have seen it bump a little bit. So certainly in your patients where you're worried about the potassium, that is a consideration that you want to think of. And it's also been associated with some, malignant hyperthermia and some other complications. So a lot of docs, that's what they came up on. That's what they trained with. And for the most part, as long as you don't have any significant contraindications, it's still an okay drug. I've just been really, training with a lot of the newer ER guys. Everybody's just been falling over to the rock uranium side of things.
Now, I think something important to remember about rock versus sucks is not the little clever nicknames that go with it, but the actual fact of how long that medication sticks around for. Sucks is great for someone who, this may be an elective or a semi-elective procedure, mm-hmm. or this is someone where you have the potential to back out, and this is not going to be a definite airway. So if you have someone that you know is going to be a definite airway, you're going to definitely put a tube down somewhere, somehow, into that trachea, or this is someone who you do not feel that sucks is safe, and you've only got those two choices, then consider rock uranium then. However, rock uranium can stick around for a mm-hmm. little bit. And so that's one of your problems, is that if you do this, are you going to be bagging this person for the next 60 minutes? That's something to keep in the back of your mind.
Right. I mean, as with anything, you need to know your conditions and your contraindications of anything that you give your patients, but you also want to think about what are going to be the sequelae of giving this. You might be able to paralyze them, and you might be able to get the tube, but like Chip said, if it's a situation where it may be a difficult airway, you want to have that patient try to start spontaneously breathing as soon as possible. Otherwise, it's going to take a lot of TLC at the bedside trying to get them back up and waiting for that to wear off before you're then going to give it another go. So we've prepared, we have positioned, we have pre-oxygenated, we have pre-medicated, we have now paralyzed, and now the only thing we have left to do is pass the tube. So Chip, you mentioned your tube size choices, anywhere between, 7 and 8, depending on male versus female. What are some of the landmarks that you're looking for when you're going in and you're asking your student, okay, what are you seeing? What are the things that you want to try to coach them through?
So I believe in Rich Levitan. So now we got to bring up two airway masters here. We've got Scott Weingart and Rich Levitan. But why try and teach something different if they're so good at it? So I believe in Rich Levitan's epiglottoscopy. You know, if you can see the epiglottis, you can figure out where you're at. So that's going to be my big question for them is, do you see the epiglottis? A lot of times, as long as the student knows what they're doing, and we've kind of talked this through a little bit, they probably do see the epiglottis. Sometimes you have to explain to them or at least remind them what the epiglottis looks like and what you're looking for with the epiglottis. But that's my first key thing is, can you see the epiglottis? So when I'm watching the student put the laryngoscope in, I'm making sure they put them in correctly. That's usually not too hard. And as long as they put it in correctly, I can usually tell that, okay, they should be somewhere close to the epiglottis. Now, if they tell me, like, say they buried that laryngoscope all the way in, they had this big Mac 4, you know, Miller-type blade, and they said, well, I can't see anything, they actually have probably gone all past the epiglottis. And so I'll tell them first, be like, okay, back up some. Mm-hmm. Back that laryngoscope up and see if you can see something better. And then, usually it's the, oh, I found the epiglottis. All right, now we know what mm-hmm. we're doing. And so if you can see the epiglottis, pretty good chance you can see the trachea, or at least you know where the trachea should be, right? If this is a difficult airway and you can't actually see the trachea, where is it supposed to be? Somewhere anterior, right? You know, that's hopefully, unless something weird's going on, you're going to know that they should be anterior to that esophagus. So for me, I want them to see the epiglottis, and then let's try and find the core.
Yep. Yep. And that's a great point. And what I'll try to do is, link to some of Rich Levitan's videos on epiglottoscopy so that you can see exactly those landmarks that you're looking for. And then, of course, I don't want to get into a lot of the, specifics of, are you using a Mac? Are you using a Miller? Where does the blade go? Because I think hopefully by the time that you're actually doing this and you're listening to this podcast to the point where you're trying to pick up some pearls, you already know which blade you're doing and or which blade you're using and where that blade is supposed to go. But that's going to be your main landmark is going to be that epiglottoscopy. You saw the landmark. Now, actually, let me back up for a second, Chip. So let me ask you this. As a preceptor, do you like to, because I've had a few of these and I've done it a few times and I actually really like it and I'm just kind of want to pick your brain a little bit about it. Do you like using the VL with your students and making them do a direct laryngoscopy with the VL blade while you're looking at the screen? Or do you like being right over their shoulder looking and seeing what they're seeing?
I hate the, and I, as a student, not that long ago myself, I really hated doing DL without the video, like a CMAC, mm-hmm. for example. Not that we're representing any brands here and no disclosures and blah, yeah. blah, blah. But anyway, the CMAC, the traditional one, has a camera on it and you can do mm-hmm. DL. I don't have that at my shop yet. I'm trying to make that okay. happen. But until then, I can't have a student practice DL and I also see what they're seeing. And I remember being that student when I was doing DL and we never had a CMAC or some sort of video screen, having the preceptor, whoever it was it the CRNA, the doc, whatever, but over my shoulder saying, what do you see? What do you see? What do you see? I don't know what the hell I'm seeing. If I knew, I'd be able to tell you. And if I saw the epiglottis already, I'd ask you for the damn
right.
tube.
It's so funny that you brought that up because right before you said that, I had a flashback PTSD moment of somebody going, what do you see? What do you see? Do you see it? What do you see? What do you see? And it's just like, I have no idea. I've got this piece of metal in this poor man's mouth and I'm just hoping that I'm seeing a hole somewhere just that I can say that I saw something.
Yep, exactly. So that's why for me, when I do this, when I'm teaching my students, if I feel super comfortable with them, and this is usually after we've done VL and we did a successful VL, then I will move on to DL with them because I'm going to stand back a little bit more. I'm going to let them do their thing. I'm going to say, if there's any hesitation, any trouble, you let me know right away and we'll take, we'll intervene. And that's just because of how it currently is. Hopefully with that CMAC, we can fix that problem. But for me right now, I'm practicing more of the VL and that's what I'm showing my
gotcha,
students.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, we've seen the epiglottis. We've got the cords. We've got the tube in place. Where do you tell your students to get that tube to? What's your markers in terms of the depth?
So I cheat, and we're going to talk about something a little different here. When I can, I'm using ultrasound.
Okay.
And so what I'm looking at is optimally, let's say best world, and I'll do this with anyone who's innovating. Doesn't matter if it's a student, another PA, a physician, whatever it is, I don't care. If I am not the one intubating, I have the ultrasound probe out, and I am actually over the trachea watching the tube go in. and I can actually see whether it's going to the esophagus or the trachea itself. And that's one of the big things is I hate when someone says, oh, yeah, I put it in. I definitely put it in. And I'm like, yeah, you're in the esophagus. You need to back out. You're wrong hole. Try again.
Ultrasound for the win.
Yes, ultrasound for the win there. Let's save a chest x-ray and let's actually save a few minutes before we figure it out we're in the wrong spot. Or they're desatting, something like that. But no, what I like to do, I want at least the cuff to get through. If you can at least get the cuff through, and a lot of times people like they hesitate for whatever reason. They don't just put the cuff through. They actually go a couple of centimeters in, basically automatically. Mm-hmm. I've had very few people who only put literally the cuff through. They like to push it back a little ways because it's until they can't see the cuff anymore is what a lot of people think in that moment. So I just tell them, make sure you get the cuff through. And if you get the cuff through, we can always push it down. But I'm trying to avoid the main stimming off the bat.
Yeah, and that's what I've always been taught too, is that it's always better, you know, unless you've got an agitated patient who's a puller, for the most part, intubation meds that you gave, both the paralytic and the sedative, are going to zork them a little bit to where they're not really going to mess with that tube. So it's always better to do your post-tube assessment, which is going to be the next P we're going to talk about, with it being a little on the high side and then advancing it a little bit, than it is for it to go right main stem, completely wide out the whole, you know, left side of the hemithorax, and then spending the next 2 hours doing recruitment maneuvers with high PEEP trying to pop them back open again. So I think that's a really good point for the students, is not, you know, don't get excited, because if you get excited that you see the cords, you're going to ram that thing home, and you want to be really careful about how deep you're going with it.
Completely agree. So I guess now it's time to talk about post-intubation, like actually assessing and stuff like that.
Yep. What's your post-tube assessment? Do you have a checklist in your brain of things that you do each time, or is it patient specific?
I do. I kind of have a generic kind of checklist I go through in my head, or again, I'm just keep bringing this up. That checklist that you should have overall should have a post-intubation sedation checklist of some kind. Well, post-intubation sedation is a whole separate beast in some ways. What I'm looking for is, like I said, if I got the ultrasound right there and I see that the tube is in the trachea, I'm going to go straight down to the lungs and I'm going to look at the lungs bilaterally and I'm going to see if there's lung sliding. And if I see lung sliding on both sides, then I have a pretty good feeling of this. And if the oxygen saturations are well and stuff like that, okay, good. We're probably in the right place. And then I'm going to worry about chest x-ray, because it's not always that radiology is right there ready to do the chest x-ray. Usually it's going to take them a few minutes to set up, and especially in a sicker patient, I don't want to wait for them to set up always. I want to be able to see real quick, okay, is there lung sliding on both sides? You know, it looks like it's in the trachea, all's well there, okay, now we're good. Now, of course, at the same time, because like I said, I'm not the one intubating if I'm doing that. If I'm the one intubating, I'm going to be worried about doing waveform capnography, or at least some way of checking end-tidal CO2 to see if I'm in the right spot that way. So for me, the airway person, the one who's actually got the airway, needs to do end-tidal CO2. The person who's off, if it's me who's off, trying to do the ultrasound. And if I don't have someone who can also do ultrasound after I've confirmed end-tidal CO2, I'm going to do the ultrasound myself and double-check everything.
Right, and that's again, a really good point that, you know, this is one of the several procedures that we do in emergency medicine where it is all hands on deck. This isn't, you know, a laceration repair where you can be in there by yourself. This is, you've got several people helping you, and this is the perfect opportunity, you know, not only as a PA, because like you said, you may not be the one doing the intubation because this may be your doc's patient, but I'm going to be in there helping them. And if I can have that ultrasound probe out, looking at things, you know, helping get some of the things set up, making sure that the end-tidal CO2 is set up and they've got the little cartridge in the monitor so that I can get plugged in, then these are the ways that you can help your, not only your doc, but if you're a student, these are the things that you can be doing to sort of help move things along and show that you know what you're talking about and ready to tackle the next procedure.
Now, something we didn't mention here, and I purposely left it out because I told you what I'm usually doing. Are you listening for lung sound?
Well, it was actually funny because I was going to mention something along those same token is, you know, old school, you know, probably what you've seen on television shows and medical dramas is as soon as that tube goes in, you've got somebody, you know, listening on the left, listening on the right, listening over the stomach. And, you know, there's a going debate right now of, is the stethoscope dying a very slow death and is ultrasound and echo taking over everything that the stethoscope can do. And I think that this is one of those prime examples where you can listen, but you're only as good as what's in between those two earbuds in your stethoscope. So if you've got that ultrasound present, you really should be using that. But if you don't, or if you're working in a setting where maybe you don't have that, well, then you're going to fall back on, you know, what you have right now. No, I don't listen. It's all ultrasound.
Awesome. Now, I would like to remind people, if you are going to use the stethoscope and you're going to listen for breath sounds and everything, you said in the order I'm so used to seeing, you know, listen to the lungs and listen to the belly. I learned doing pre-hospital, you don't really want to do that way. Listen to the belly first. If you hear bubbles, okay, that's already a problem. If you're hearing the stomach gurgling, then that automatically brings up my level of concern quite a bit. If I made you do 5-6 breaths before I even get down to the stomach, think about that. If you put the tube in the wrong place for whatever reason, now you put 5-6 good breaths of air into the belly, what's that going to do later? That's going to cause a big problem mm-hmm. for you. So if you listen to the stomach first, do that and then go to the lungs. I think that's one of the big tips everyone forgets.
Yeah, that's
about.
That's a great pro tip right there. You know, not a lot of people get the pre-hospital experience, and these are the guys that are really a lot of the airway masters, because you guys are doing it in situations and in settings that, you know, nobody really wants to intubate in. They want to be in a nice warm recess room where they have all of the bells and whistles and everything. But when you get good at being able to intubate somebody in the bathroom stall, you're going to know very quickly your economy of movements and the things that you want to know. And these are the kind of things that maybe you don't get to pick up on unless you're working with somebody like Chip, who's got that pre-hospital experience. And that's a great, great tip.
You only need one patient to vomit on you after you do that to realize you screwed up.
Yep. And there it is. It's that one time. It's just that one time, and then you'll never, ever forget it again. So now, in terms of, you know, we went through, you know, end tidal CO2, looking with the ultrasound, making sure you're seeing the lung sliding, doing all of that. What has really come into play over the last, certainly this year, has really been a wave, at least in the emergency room, of, you know, post-intubation sedation. And what kind of medicine, what kind of medicines you're going to use for that. And again, historically, you know, most people are going to go straight to that propofol drip. But again, we've kind of already belabored it, is, you know, propofol is good for certain settings. I listened to, you know, a really guy, I think it actually was the very first SMAC conference where they had a debate of propofol. And one anesthesiologist said that propofol was the milk of lactating angels. And the other one said that propofol was the semen of the devil. And I've never actually forgotten that. So it's good. You're going to find people that really, really like it. And you're going to find other people that really, really hate it. So what do you normally like to use for your sedation post tube?
Actually, I've got a little mini rant on this. I'm going to talk more about what I don't use.
That's even better.
Not saying that you can't do this, but I'm saying if you don't do this correctly and I find out about it, I would like to hunt you down and do this to you and then see if you think this is a problem. And that is only giving a paralytic. That is one of my biggest pet peeves. And if I see that you have a patient who you just intubated, let's say you did sucks right off the bat because you were just trying to do this quick, you did your traditional sucks and etomidate, those medications don't last for very long. And then your patient starts bucking on the vent and you're worried, like, oh, there's a problem. And so I've seen more than once someone say, oh yeah, just go ahead and give them a bolus of some rock uronium. And when I see that, I just cringe every time, because the patient's still there. Now, what did we just talk about was when you put them down, make sure you give your analgesic first, not your paralytic, and make sure you give time before you put that paralytic in, because in some people, that analgesic will take a little bit longer to do. Uh-huh. So please, please, please do not use a paralytic. And if you are, for some reason, think you're going to be smart and do it, you better sure as hell sedate them first as much as possible. And I'm one to believe that if you do proper analgesia, you'll achieve your sedation. If you're someone where I'm just going to do a propofol drip on, let's say it's the appropriate patient, but you're just going to do a propofol drip, last I checked, propofol doesn't really do anything for the actual analgesia mm-hmm. side. You need to come up with some way. Now, this is a time when I'd say that ketamine is a great mm-hmm. option. Especially if you induced with ketamine, so you've already got that person on ketamine, you gave them a bolus, right? Hopefully you did
Right.
up front, is that, great, now you move on to a ketamine drip, problem solved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things are taken care of. If you need to, add a little bit of fentanyl, add a little bit of propofol, do whatever else is appropriate, but please do not do the paralytic by itself or achieve the paralytic. There's very few patients. There may be some examples where you may want to have a paralytic on board, but most of the time you don't. And think about it. When they go to the ICU, are they paralyzing this patient the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
No. What they're doing is they're actually doing proper sedation.
Right.
So don't screw around with this. Don't just use rock. Don't just use whatever kind of paralytic. I don't care if it's vecuronium or sucks either. Don't do that. Be smart. If the person's bucking the vent, it's because it hurts. If you don't believe me, try and shove a tube down your throat and see how that goes and leave it
exactly.
there.
Exactly. I mean, you really, if there's one thing from a RSI, rapid sequence intubation, that you really just need to get hammered in your brain is that you very, very rarely, very rarely are ever going to paralyze without sedating or giving something beforehand. So never think of the paralytics as the end all be all. You need it because it's certainly going to help you, you know, achieve what you need to see and get that tube in place, but it's never a medicine that you should just be giving unless there is some form of anxiolytic or analgesic on board prior to.
100% agree.
All right. So we did, I think we covered everything. We prepared, we pre-oxygenated, we pre-medicated, we gave our sedative, we paralyzed, we passed the tube, and we did our post-intubation assessment, and then we did our post-intubation care plan. You know, I don't really think we need to really go into, you know, how to use secure tubes and, you know, all these other things, because I think everybody's got their own way of doing it, whether you're, you know, an old school tape and tongue blade, or are you one of the new fancy, you know, ET tube lockers. It really doesn't matter. Just know that at some point after that tube's in place and you've assessed that it's in the right place, that you're then going to have that tube secured. And 9 times out of 10, it's either somebody from the nursing staff or from respiratory, but it is worthwhile as a student to look and see exactly how they do it, because it is going to make your life easier learning forward of all the things that that go into making sure that tube is secure, especially if you're in a outlying hospital who you're going to be transferring some patients. You want to make sure that that tube is in place so it doesn't come out en route.
And I'd like to bring up about two other points that I can think of directly related to that. Again, you learn from experience. You don't want to learn the hard way. Don't let go of the tube until it's secure, because that just looks bad on everyone, especially when it's a difficult airway and someone let go of the tube and now we have to do this all over
mm-hmm.
again. Because trust me, it gets harder each time you try and do it. You want to get on the first pass for a reason. The other big point is you don't necessarily have to, but I would highly encourage an NG or an OG tube, something that goes in the belly to help keep that down, especially in the emergency medicine setting where this person probably was not fasting. More likely they just ate a Big Mac, had about 2 beers at least. They say it's just 2 beers, and then got in a fight and got his ass kicked. And so if that's the problem, they probably got stuff in their belly that's just waiting to come up. So suction is your friend.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
So I hope this podcast is not meant to be rated G. I kind of went off there a couple of times.
Oh, I think we're fine. I think we're fine from an Apple standpoint. I actually had to look it up when I first started to just see how willy-nilly I needed to go and what was appropriate and what wasn't and what you needed in order to, you know, get the dreaded E label on the iTunes. And I think we're okay.
Okay,
I think we're
good,
okay.
Good.
This is what happens when you get two guys that are PAs that work in emergency medicine is, you know, we're all kind of cut from the same cloth and our brains are wired and short-wired around the same, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. The filter comes and goes, and hopefully the filter's on around patients. Sometimes it fails, usually around drug seekers for me. So, you got to be a little careful.
Absolutely,
on that.
Absolutely.
So can I do a shameless plug here real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have talked a lot about airway. We've talked about basic, and I'm sure you are going to have more stuff eventually on airway designed for students. My stuff that I've had before, this is the first time to go back and do a little more of a basics type review, and I will probably build off of this on some things. We already got my big rant out of the way about paralytic. I do have some other podcasts, about 6 other podcasts at least, that are devoted to airway. And so if you're a student or anyone else and you want a little deeper dive into some of this, go to Total EM and listen to that, because we're going to have even more detail. And that's totalem.org.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, this is our, at least my first soiree into the interviewing podcast. And I think that, like Chip said at the very beginning, you know, there's not a lot out there on, you know, podcast by PAs for PAs. So I know him and I have been in conversation about trying to branch out and do as much of this as we can, with my focus being more sort of pants, PANRI, and students, and his being more of an emergency medicine background. I think there's a lot of an overlap, especially with your experience of working in internal medicine and a lot of these other things that I think we're going to try to branch out and do a lot more of these, and be able to sort of bounce back and forth, hopefully, between the two podcasts of, you know, maybe doing a little bit more basic on my show and then maybe doing more of a deep dive on yours to the practicing PA who is out there and doing things. So I think that that's a good way for us to be able to approach that, is that we got your basics now, and now that you know where the foundation has been laid, now you can go and now you can have some really good conversations and or some really good podcasts with Chip talking to, you know, some really good airway gurus that are out there in the foam world, and you know, maybe there are some things in there that you didn't quite understand or didn't wrap your head around, and hopefully we have, you know, elucidated a little bit on that and made it a little bit more clear for you.
And if you have any questions, let Chris or I know, and we will probably get back at some point, hopefully between the students and the professionals that are out there. There may be some things that we need to cover a little bit more that weren't covered in other podcasts, or just our perspectives on things. And so hopefully there may be a part two down the line, you could say.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I guess on that note, like I said, it's great to have you as a co-host. Hopefully we can do the co-hosting more often. It's nice to not be the only one talking.
I will tell you that it has been actually fun. I was a little bit nervous doing it, only because this is the first time that I've actually had to talk to somebody else over the podcast. But I will tell you, this is actually a lot of fun, and I like the banter. And you know, one of the things I have found doing the podcast and you know, certainly thinking about things, and I don't know if you've sort of experienced this a little bit too, is, you know, you try to do as good of research as you can and try to come up with the most up-to-date information as you can, but you're still biased by your own opinion. And although I think you and I overlapped on a lot of this stuff, there's some things that you have done that I haven't even thought of yet. So having two brains on one podcast where the majority of the information is shared, there are some things where we can kind of bounce back and say, well, you know, I've actually done this because I've got the experience in it. And I think that we're going to be able to identify a whole bunch of topics moving forward where we can kind of play off of that. So absolutely. I think we're going to have some fun in the coming years doing this.
Absolutely agree. Well, I guess we should end it for this time. Do you think?
Yeah.
Chris?
Yep. I think we're stretching probably the attention span of most of the ER students and PAs out there, I'm sure.
Well, I was already paying attention to the squirrels outside, so I forgot what you said. But I guess until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.